read by Stephanie Cole.
It's so important, said Flora Martin, that the children should connect with members of the extended family. Her husband, John, barely looked up from his newspaper. Sure, he said. Although teenagers have their own agenda, don't they? I'm not sure if they really want to connect. Oh, I think they're interested, said Flora. Polly said to me the other day that she was rather looking forward to having Cousin Grace here over Christmas. She said it would make it less boring for her. John snorted. So much for our company. Well, if you're 18, I suppose you and I are not exactly riveting. She thinks adults are boring. Whereas Cousin Grace, John began. Well, I'm not sure I know all that much about her. I've only met her a few times in my life, and of course she's my parents' generation rather than mine. She spent a lot of time abroad, but I expect they'll probably discover she's every bit as boring as we are. Well, I told them all that they were to make her as welcome as possible, Flora said. I told them that they were to listen to her politely. You know how people of that vintage can go on and on. They were to be polite. Good, said John. And it's only for a couple of days, after all. We can put on a brave face if needs be. He paused. You said she thinks adults are boring, does she? Well, we are, I suppose, said Flora. A bit, anyway. Now the three teenagers sat in orderly silence at the kitchen table. Cousin Grace, dressed in a purple shift dress and wearing a double string of cultivated pearls, surveyed them with interest. They were alone in the house, Flora and John having gone out to a pre-Christmas cocktail party held by a colleague of John's. "We're so sorry to have to go out on the first evening of your visit," said John apologetically. "This thing had been arranged a long time ago, and we'd accepted. You know how it is. I hope things won't be too dull for you." Cousin Grace waved a hand airily. "I completely understand one has to lead one's normal life in spite of guests, and I'm sure I'm going to be well looked after by the family." "They've been briefed," said Flora. "There's a bottle of sherry and some nipples. They know where it is, and they'll fix you up. It'll be a nice opportunity for you to get to know one another." "Exactly," said Cousin Grace. "Now you run along, you mustn't be late." At 18, and therefore the oldest, Polly took the initiative. Her brothers, Andrew and Billy, were learning, but still had the awkwardness of the young teenage years. "Ma's left some sherry in the fridge," she said. "Can I get you some?" Cousin Grace looked at her watch. "It's martini time," she said. "I believe in being punctual for martinis. Auden was like that, you know. He always had a martini at 6 on the dot."
"Auden?" asked Andrew.
"W.H. Auden," said Cousin Grace. "The poet. He had a martini at the same time every day. He was very punctilious about such things, and rightly so. One should always be regular in one's habits."
"What goes into a martini?" asked Billy.
"Gin," said Cousin Grace, "and you add a bit of vermouth, but not too much. I much prefer my martinis dry." She paused. "That means without too much vermouth."
"Do you like sherry?" asked Andrew.
Cousin Grace wrinkled her nose.
"I much prefer martinis. In fact, I've brought you young people a little present, a cocktail shaker. I saw it in an antique shop and couldn't resist it. It's Art Deco, which I love, and you know what? I'm going to give it to you early. Do you know if there's any gin in the house? If you could find some, I'll let you watch me mixing one. Just for me, of course. You boys are a bit on the young side for such things. Plenty of time for martinis in the future when you're a bit older."
Andrew's eyes widened. He and Billy were twins and had just passed their 16th birthday.
"Of course, you're 18, aren't you, dear?" said Cousin Grace to Polly. "You presumably know all about martinis, but I shan't lead you astray. That would never do. You can look after the shaker until everybody's safely over 21.
Polly left the room and returned with a bottle of gin and a second.
"And I found this," she said, flourishing a bottle of vermouth. "My dear," exclaimed Cousin Grace, who had now unwrapped an elegant silver cocktail shaker, "such perfect serendipity. Be an angel and get some ice. Then I shall mix myself a little pick-me-up and tell you all about what I've been up to over the last 40 years. Ever since I went out into the world at exactly your age, Polly, launched like a ship on the oceans." She looked at the boys. "I shall bowdlerise, of course, in view of your tender years." "Bowdlerise?" asked Billy. "If one has to ask the meaning of bowdlerisation, then bowdlerisation is, alas, necessary," said Cousin Grace. "But first the martini. Then I'll tell you all about my husband's. I've had 4, you see, which is a little bit over the average. Quite a bit over the average, I suppose, but life's like that, you know, full of surprises." She took a sip of her martini. "Perfect," she said. "Now, let's go back to when I was 18. It was, as the song goes, a very good year. I had left school under a bit of a cloud, a fairly large cloud, in fact, but we won't go there, as you young people say these days. I was a bit of a rebel, but who isn't at that age? I wasn't very academic, you know, in the accepted sense, but since I was frightfully good at art, I managed to talk myself into a 6-month scholarship to Florence. I studied painting in a real studio. I mostly did life drawing. We had models coming in, you see, and posing for us, and some of them were utterly charming. Usually broke, of course, which is why they had to model for artists, but wonderfully good-looking. You know how the Italians can be, smoulderingly attractive. So I married one of them. He was called Carlo, and we were blissfully happy, until he was seized by the army for national service. He tried to shoot a toe off so that he wouldn't have to serve, but the gun jammed, and they got him before he could pull the trigger again. Poor Carlo, off into some terrible Alpine regiment. Well, what could I do? I had no money, and Carlo received almost no pay. So we agreed that it probably wasn't such a good idea to be married after all, and Carlo arranged for the whole thing to be set aside on the grounds of his insanity. This was done by an uncle of his, who was a psychiatrist, who was prepared to declare anybody insane for the appropriate fee. They also tried to use the declaration of insanity to get him out of the army, but the army said it didn't matter as far as they were concerned, and he could serve in a unit that was specially set up for insane people. So I think he had to serve the full term, poor dear. Polly was listening wide-eyed. "I hope they looked after him," she said. "Oh, they did," answered Grace. "They made him a sergeant, because he was the sanest one there. For my part, I decided to go to Spain, because I knew somebody who had moved to Madrid, and she'd offered to let me stay in her flat. I thought that it might be an idea to get married again, as I was really not very happy on my own, and it would be far easier if I had a husband. So I went with my friend to a tapas bar that had been recommended to us as a place where women who were looking for husbands went, and that's where I met Antonio. Now, Antonio was a real sweetie. He was one of those rather old-fashioned Spaniards, you know the type, with very elaborate formal manners, and I've always had my head turned by manners of that sort. He was a dream of a man, and when, after our 4th date, he asked me to marry him, I agreed, there and then. Antonio had a rather unusual profession. He was a bullfight journalist. He covered the big bullfights for the national press and was very well known and appreciated, I believe, in bullfighting circles. I went off with him to the corridas, but honestly, I couldn't abide them. I thought the whole business was cruel and unnecessary, and I made it quite clear to him that I wasn't going to put up with it. I gave him an ultimatum, and I said that he would have to give up covering bullfighting for the newspapers, or I would leave. He said, "What do you expect me to do?" And I told him that if he came back to Britain with me, he would almost certainly get a job on a newspaper or a magazine. He agreed, and we came back to this country. I took a job working in an art materials shop in Bristol, and he found a job writing for a farming magazine. It was reasonably well paid, and he did it for years and years. but he always held it against me that he'd been reduced from writing about bullfighting to writing about pigs and so on. And so I'm afraid we started to drift apart. He took up with a woman who farmed cattle, and we parted amicably enough. I decided to go to France. "To find another husband?" asked Polly.
Grace smiled. "How did you guess?"
"Well, my next husband was a detective in the Paris police. He was a charming man with a wonderfully retentive memory. He remembered everything said to him by anybody, including me, which became a bit awkward. He started to find inconsistencies in the things I said about, well, everything, really. And so we sort of drifted apart," said Polly. "Yes, we drifted apart. And I went off to Antibes, where I met an absolutely charming banker. He had his own bank, not a big one, but a delightful little bijou bank that had the sweetest front door. He was immensely generous. Bunches of flowers would arrive in the house every day. Yes, every day, with marvellously romantic messages. He was such a lovely man. And then..." She looked down at her glass. "He was so loyal, so loving, but I found him just a tiny bit boring. We parted great friends, though." There was a silence. "So that makes four," said Polly. "Four husbands so far. Will there be more?"
"Oh, goodness me," said Cousin Grace. "Who can tell? The future conceals husbands from the present."
She paused.
"Who said that?"
"I probably did. One never attributes an aphorism to oneself, does one? It's always somebody else." There was a ring at the door.
"The front door?" said Cousin Grace.
Polly nodded. "Probably a delivery. I'll go and see." She left the room, to return a few minutes later with a tall, elegantly dressed man.
"Stanley!" exclaimed Cousin Grace.
"Grace!"
Ignoring the teenagers, he crossed the room to embrace her.
"I just can't bear to be without you," he said. "I've tried and tried, but I can't."
The children watched, open-mouthed.
"The car's waiting outside," he said.
She hesitated. "I suppose I really must."
"Yes, you must."
"I haven't even unpacked," she said. "My case is still in the hall."
"I'll carry it for you," offered Billy.
The man looked at him.
"Good boy," he said.
"Would you give my apologies to your parents?" said Cousin Grace as she prepared to leave the kitchen.
"We'll tell them," said Andrew. "We must spend Christmas together some other time," said Cousin Grace. "Life is so full, but we'll arrange something or other."
They watched her leave. The car was a large silver Bristol, an open tourer.
"Wow," said Billy, "look at that."
Andrew sighed. He looked wistful. Billy looked wistful too. And Polly.
Stephanie Cole was reading The Colourful Life of Cousin Grace, a new short story for Radio 4 by Alexander McCall-Smith. The producer was Kirstine Cameron. BBC News at 11 o'clock. Prison officers are attempting to contain a disturbance at Swaleside Jail on the Isle of Sheppey in Kent, where around 60 inmates took control of a landing. Specialist teams are being sent in by the prison service. It's the fourth such incident in less than 2 months in English jails. Earlier, members of the Prison Officers Association rejected a deal on pay and pensions that would have allowed them to retire at 65. Union leaders had backed the proposal, but members voted against it. More talks will take place next year. The Syrian government has taken full control of Aleppo in the biggest victory for President Assad in the six-year conflict. It came after the last of the 35,000 fighters and civilians were brought out of eastern districts this evening. This Syrian soldier there said they would continue to fight until the whole of Syria had been taken from the rebels.
This victory in Aleppo is the victory of all Syria. We dedicate it to our president, Bashar al-Assad. This is not over. What we've chased away in Aleppo will be fought back everywhere until the last one.
A cabin crew strike at British Airways on Christmas Day and Boxing Day has been called off. The Unite Union said it would now ballot its members on a new pay deal. Donald Trump has said in a tweet that the US must strengthen and expand its nuclear capability. However, the president-elect's transition team have since clarified the comment, saying he was talking about the need to prevent nuclear proliferation, particularly in regard to rogue states and terrorists. Alan Pardew has lost his job as Crystal Palace manager. The club have had one win in 11 games and have the worst record of all 92 league clubs in 2016. Sam Allardyce is the bookmaker's favourite to replace Pardew. The Queen and the Duke of Edinburgh have arrived at Sandringham in Norfolk for their Christmas break. The couple postponed their journey yesterday because they both had heavy colds. They travelled by helicopter instead of train. BBC News.
What broke your heart in 2016?
I can't believe I'm even saying this. It's not news that I want to be reporting, but we can confirm there was a statement on David Bowie's official Twitter and Facebook confirming that he has died.
David Bowie's music is an absolute central tenet of what we do here at Six Music, so forgive us if we're all a little bit shell-shocked by it.
Listen to the moments that moved us all in 2016. Go to bbc.co.uk/heartheyear.
In half an hour here on Radio 4, the poet Mike Garry will be dropping in on his childhood playground, the Moss Side Leisure Centre, to perform his poem Men's Morning. That's at 11:30 here on Radio 4. But first, here's another touch of wonderment.